Hello and welcome back to Talking of Books. I'm Annabelle Corton and with me in the studio today is William Jones, or Wilster as I like to call him, and he doesn't like me calling him. And our special young reviewer today, we have Taher Kathawala, and I hope I pronounced that right, and if not, please don't hurt me. We're going to be discussing Pathfinders, The Golden Age of Arabic Science by Jim Al-Khalili, I believe, unless you've changed it at the last minute and haven't told me.
No, Wilster's got it right.
Okay. See, Wilster, see, I'm making it a thing.
You know, he's a high school student, so I can understand it. You know, my high school students call me Mr. J, so life's good. I used to teach high school for 4 years. I've taught high school, and then I've also taught people in, you know, prisons. So in the States, not much really changed. This is a fascinating book, actually. It really is. One of my degrees is in history. And we're talking about Pelican Books. It's Jim Al-Khalili, Pathfinders, The Golden Age of Arabic Science. And I'm going to just pass the ball to Taher. Tell us, why'd you choose this?
Okay, so the kind of world we're living in right now and the kind of global climate that we're seeing is like people are concerned about stuff like climate change, but in reality, most of what's going on in the world is driven by humans, right? So the whole of the Middle East right now is kind of in turmoil. That's how it's been for the last few years, right? When we think of the Middle East, we don't really think of contribution. We don't really think of science. We don't really think of art and culture. We think more of, you know, death, destruction, and violence. And that wasn't okay. That's not okay. So what Jim Al-Khalili set out to do was to revive the kind of golden history of Arabic science within the Middle East. And he did that in a very charming way through Pathfinders, which is why I thought we should probably discuss it today.
Yeah, this is fantastic. I love some of the lines that come out of the book. And these are things that, you know, I want to make this phrase very carefully. Many people in America, I am an American, we all know what happened on 9/11. I'm not even going to go into it. But my family and I left America because the country became so anti-Islam, anti-Muslim. And, you know, when you hear in America, oh, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Oh, he says this, all these horrible things. And I love the line that's in this book that from the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, it says, the ink of the scholar is more sacred than the blood of the martyr.
I read that too. That's beautiful.
That's amazing. And, you know, I went to a really good school when I was in high school, and I only know about a quarter of the scientists and philosophers that are mentioned in this book. So this is a very fascinating read. What caused you to pick it up?
You probably know these scientists through their Latinized names more than their Arabic names as well, like Averroes, Avicenna, Ibn al-Haytham, you probably don't know, Ibn Rushd, which is their actual real names. And then there's, of course, Algorithmus, which is like where we derive the word algorithm. What made me pick up this book was the fact that Jim Al-Khalili is a very interesting character in and of himself. He's a professor. He's a knighted professor who's Iraqi-born. He's British. He himself is currently a chief professor of theoretical physics at the University of Surrey. And his father is a Shia Muslim. His mother is a Protestant Christian. And he himself, by his own words, doesn't have a single religious bone in his body. So you've got this dynamic character whose entire book about Muslim scientists and Arabic science, and he chooses to use the words Arabic science because the contributions don't just come exclusively from Muslims. They come from the Arabic region as a whole. So the entire book is kind of underscored with pride. I mean, if you had to have one word just come shining straight out of the covers, it wouldn't be like science or achievement or accomplishment. It would be pride. You know, you can feel it in every kind of sentence of the book that he's so proud of his heritage and of where he's coming from. And he's very melancholic that, you know, that he can't, that no one in the world seems to know about Ibn Rushd and Ibn al-Haytham, whereas everybody seems to know about Da Vinci and Newton, etc. So I thought that's another story that in this small little segment is worth bringing up.
Oh, no, I concur. It was eye-opening, the amount of things that I didn't know about it. And you know, I like the region. Science is one of the things I love in history. He handles it in a very direct way, and I, like you said, very be proud. And where do you think he's going with this, other than just be proud of it? What is his call to action?
Right. He's not being apologetic at any point in the book, right? Throughout the all the pages, basically, he's making it explicitly clear that what the world has come to now is not a reflection of the Middle East history, and it doesn't have to be a reflection of the Middle East future, right? So what he's trying to say is that in the past, we had things like the Bayt al-Hikmah, which is the House of Wisdom, right? The Middle East was the powerhouse of knowledge of the world. And there's absolutely no reason why the same can't be said of the future, right? So he's probably trying to say through bringing alive the history, the past, the only reason we even focus on history is to improve our future as a whole, right? As a species. So we don't make the same mistakes again. So in this situation, he's saying we had a golden age of Arabic science when Europe was in the Dark Ages, right? The so-called Dark Ages of the world. They weren't really the Dark Ages of the world. They were just the Dark Ages of Europe. And you know how history is written by the people who win, right? Mm-hmm. So in a little while, when Europe had won everything, they decided to rewrite history and say, or Europe or whoever the colonial powers were at the time, decided to rewrite history and say, okay, nothing was happening in the world at the time. But then it was the same European scientists and mathematicians that used the achievements of the Middle Eastern Arabic scientists and acknowledged them. I mean, Fibonacci, he acknowledged the genius of Avicenna and Averroes. And this is Fibonacci we're talking about, right? He's one of the greatest mathematicians of all time. So at the time, they acknowledged the greatness of these scientists. But over time, this story was kind of lost in the fabric of time. So now we have an opportunity here. You know, when the way information is proliferating, the way it's spreading over time, we have an opportunity to bring that story back to life and to show us what we could be. So what he's trying to say is, without targeting any group in particular, he's just trying to say that as a region as a whole, we need to stop focusing on, like, war and violence and weapons, and we need to start focusing on what we can accomplish. And that's his call to action, according to me.
From reviews and things that I've read, a lot of the descriptions about this book have been that the Arab physicists, scientists, and great thinkers of the time, they had all this knowledge, and then that was sort of, they used the metaphor of passing a torch on to Western philosophers, Western thinkers, and whatnot. Do you agree with that, or do you think that it was, there was some overlapping, there was some cross-pollination of thoughts and ideas, or do you think that once the theories were passed on, they were sort of forgotten about?
I think the whole of human knowledge is a cumulative effort, right? I mean, nobody denies that. Like, not one single person or one single region or any one given era has defined the whole of human knowledge. Sure, we've got the Greeks back in, like, the 5th century. They're like, okay, like Socrates and Aristotle and Plato, fine, they were brilliant, they were geniuses. They kind of set us up to kind of gather our knowledge. But it took like 2 millennia of thinkers to get us to where we are, like to sit in a radio station like this and discuss something like with such an age gap between all of us, with such a cultural gap between all of us, to discuss such a complex topic. We didn't get here just based on one person and one region and one era. So in a sense, all kind of human knowledge, all kind of work that we do is kind of passing a torch between eras and times. But in this particular situation, the kind of way we've seen things, the way we've seen the knowledge die, the effort, the drive to seek information, the way Jamal Khalili describes it in the book is the reason Islam was so influential at the time was because we had this movement called the Mu'tazilites, right? What they believed was the Quran. I myself am a Muslim, so I share some of these views. The Quran contains all the answers you could possibly ever need as a human, right? And we're not just talking about, you know, how you live your life or how do you wear your pants. We're talking about the serious stuff, like the universe, like stars, the sky, the way the orbits move, right?
Well, how you wear your pants isn't important.
It's all about perspective,
okay.
I suppose.
Oh, I feel
silly. So basically, what these Mu'tazilites would do is they would observe the universe. They would observe nature. Okay, they would derive knowledge from their surroundings, which is another Quranic call to action. It's within the Quran itself. Observe nature. Observe what your God has created, then return. You know? So then they would come back to the Quran and study it. And they would have that drive to improve their own knowledge in order to understand the Quran better. But then there was another movement of Islam, which was far more traditionalist, which is probably more in keeping with kind of the more extremist movements we see currently today. It's very reminiscent of that, you know? So, I mean, if those people are now, they'd be kind of nostalgic for the old days, basically. So these groups of people, what they ended up doing was they took Islam away from that kind of logical, speculative kind of region, and they moved it towards a more traditional approach. And that traditional approach was not necessarily conducive to our building of a knowledge base, which is why European scientists took over information from the past, and then they improved on it.
Okay. I'd like to just ask you, I mean, things that I've been reading about the particular things that were discovered are just absolutely fascinating. For example, years ago, I mean, you wouldn't think that they'd be able to do this, but they managed to measure, in particular, the Persian Al-Biruni managed to measure the height of a mountain and the angle of dip of the horizon to calculate the circumference of the planet to within an accuracy of 1%. Now, that's amazing.
When he had no calculators, no internet, no computers, and
I can't add up my receipts. I mean, this is just wonderful. I was blown away by this. Did you have anything that you were reading in this book that you just thought, wow? Any particular discovery that just knocked your socks off?
Possibly Ibn al-Haytham. This is maybe the, if you were reading the books, this is probably something that maybe won't stand out to you directly. But what Ibn al-Haytham did, he's probably the first example to me of somebody who thought in reverse. You know, really, really thought in reverse. The Olympic world champion for pole vaulting right now, everybody at his time was running, and they used to jump, they used to try and leap straight over the pole. What he did was,
high jump.
He did it in reverse. So he ran and he jumped in reverse. And that's the technique every Olympic champion uses now, right?
The Fosbury flop.
The Fosbury flop. What Ibn al-Haytham did was he was the first scientist to postulate that light enters our eyes, not the other way around. Every thinker before him always assumed that light leaves our eyes, like lasers, and then bounces off objects around us. Here comes Ibn al-Haytham, and he goes, okay, no, that doesn't make any sense, because he thought about the moon, and he thought, you know, I thought at night, like, how do we see at night? Like, I mean, like, why can't we see at night if there's light coming out of our eyes? So he thought, okay, we need light in order to see, therefore light must go into our eyes. And his thought process was so incredibly simple. And, I mean, Al-Kindi, again, he thought about infinity, right? He thought about the concept of infinity. And he was one of the first people to realize what took other scientists centuries to realize in terms of infinity. What some of the most remarkable achievements of these scientists and mathematicians haven't been complicated or complex. They've been incredibly, beautifully, elegantly simple. And I think those are the things that stand out to me from the book.
Okay. Well, you know what? Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
Ladies first.
Ladies first. We've been very chivalrous today. Please stay tuned. We'll be back a bit later to talk about Jim Al-Khalili's Pathfinders with Tahan.
From Jane Austen to George Orwell, this is Talking of Books in association with Emirates Airline Festival of Literature, only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good morning and welcome back to Talking of Books. I'm Will Jones, or as I've been called, the Wilster. With me is Annabel Corton and Tahir, and we're discussing Jim Al-Khalili's Pathfinders, the Golden Age of Arabic Science. And with that, we have our second quiz question, so you can win a copy of it, and it really is a good read. All right, the question. Jim Al-Khalili is a well-known scientist. He's a professor at the University of Surrey. He's won numerous awards and accolades. Just to keep it very easy and going forward, what branch of science is he a professor of? Okay? And if you haven't been listening and you're not paying attention, you naughty people, you can use your friend Mr. Google.
No, you can't. They can't use Google. That's cheating. All right, use Google. We're not going to know, are we? I have a question for you, Taha. I would like to ask you a cheesy question, if that's allowed. Do you mind me asking you a cheesy question?
Nah, it depends.
Who inspires you? I just think it's interesting that you picked this book up about Arabic science, and I just wondered if you were inspired by anybody to do that, or you just simply saw the book and thought, wow, that's what I'm going to talk about.
Yeah, so I guess I was bored one Friday night, decided I want to read about medieval Arabic science. I was like, yeah, why not?
Yeah, as we all do.
Yeah, what else do you do Friday night, huh? Okay, So Jamal Khalili himself is, I'm not going to give away the answer to the quiz question, but he himself is a very well-renowned scientist. So he wrote a book called Paradox. And at the time, I was quite interested in paradoxes because, I was, you know, they're really counterintuitive. They don't, typically, the definition is they don't really make sense to us. So I thought, you know, are these really paradoxes? I mean, and he tries to explain away some of them. And they're age-old questions, like the grandfather paradox and that. You know, if you go back and kill your grandfather, would you ever be born? That kind of question, you know.
And if you're not born, how could you go back and kill your grandfather?
Exactly. So it's stuff like that, you know, logical kind of inferences. Of course, like 90% of the book went straight over my head. But, I mean, after that, I found myself quite interested in some of his work. And then I picked up, my brother actually got me the Golden Age of Arabic Science. He's like 13 right now. So he himself has no interest in any of this stuff. But he knew I liked it, so he thought, you know, why not? So he picked it up for me, and I began skimming through it, and I found a lot of it very interesting. But then there is, a lot of it was to do with school, right? So there's this program called the GEMS Honors Program, and Mr. Rohan Roberts runs it from the Winchester School. And one of the topics we were discussing a while back was scientists of the past and, you know, achievements of the past. And the Golden Age of Arabic Science, we were kind of discussing more unconventional stuff along with the conventional stuff. So the conventional stuff being like the Greek history and the unconventional stuff being this. So the book, the topic of focus was the Golden Age of Arabic Science. And I found it like a perfect opportunity to pick it back up again. And it's been a couple of years since my brother got it for me, and I found myself a lot more interested and a lot more invested. So I suppose in terms of what inspires me, it would probably be boredom. it was a remarkably, remarkably interesting book, and I find myself very fortunate to have read it. So,
can I ask just a little bit of background? What school do you go to?
Wellington, Silicon Oasis.
All right, and what year are you in that school?
11.
You're 11, so you're going to be graduating in 2 years.
Hopefully, if everything goes to plan.
If you're reading this, you'll be doing
well. I think you'll be fine.
What majors are you looking into, or university-wise?
University-wise, well, I mean, the world is about as unpredictable as the Middle East at the moment, so I'm not really going to set my hopes on anything right now. Probably like US, UK-ish, because it does give you the backing to come back to the Middle East. And
I was meaning more in the programs of study.
I like to think I might go into research and innovation, but at the same time, I don't really, because first of all, research is such a wide, huge-ranging field. Like, I don't really know what to pick within it. And then second, it's kind of a throwaway answer for whenever anybody asks me, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? I can't really go, you know, I don't really know.
So, you got it down. What particular scientists in here inspire you the most from going over this list? It almost seems like your teacher was, you said you had the conventional and the unconventional. It was kind of like, these are the really normal people, but let's go study these cool people that nobody knows.
Yes,
exactly. And is that the way your instructors brought it up to you?
Kind of, yeah. To be honest, that was probably exactly the kind of vibe we got from it. Because, you know, the conventional stuff, the really, really conventional stuff for kids our age would be like, I don't know, studying. What do we study? I don't know. But
if you were left in science, you'd be doing Newton. You'd be doing, you know, maybe some learning a little bit about Faraday.
Right, so Newton and Faraday, yeah, or Galileo. Let's look at that. And of course, those scientists were great. But the thing is, everyone knows about them. So we had to study some scientists that defined the world, and nobody really knows who they are, which is very, very strange, to say the least. So from the book, the one scientist or mathematician that sticks out is probably the one that whose contribution influences, well, all of them do, but the one that influences our lives directly, and the one we study in like sixth grade, Al-Khwarizmi. Al-Khwarizmi's Latinized name is Algorithmus, which is, as I mentioned earlier, where we get the word algorithm from. He basically single-handedly invented algebra, which is maybe an unfair thing to say because, I mean, Jamal Khalili himself says in the book that his own kind of pride on the topic may have once got him to not look at it from an objective perspective. And a speaker an audience member at one of his speeches got up and said to him, you know, this is not where algebra began. Algebra began with the Greeks, right? And he acknowledges that. But no one before Al-Khwarizmi said about the kind of balance that we see in algebra, you know, where on one side of an equation you have this, on the other side you have this. The most remarkable thing about his book was Well, two things I find particularly remarkable about his book. Number one, there was not a single symbol in it. It was all written. So when he would write out an equation, how we would write, you know, 2 plus x equals 4, he wouldn't write that. He would say 2 and an unknown gives you this. So in questions where you have these incredibly long equations, I can see our lady over here getting ruffled by that thought.
Yeah, just thinking how much longer my exam papers would have been.
Well, I've done calculus, so just imagine like, the images going through my head, the integral of the equation of
exactly
the function of x.
Oh, nightmare.
To, and word it, oh my God.
So one basic equation would be about a paragraph long.
Yeah.
And he had to do that in order to explain it to the rest of the world. And then, of course, later on, other Arabic scientists and Persian scientists kind of took it on and developed the symbols and the kind of the kind of things we use and the way we see algebra today. It was developed over time. The first page of his book was actually dedicated to Islam. The first page of Al-Khwarizmi's book, the seminal paper that defined algebra, the first page was dedicated to Islam. And that's a remarkable thought. In today's world, if you go to see that the book that defined algebra began with a dedication to God, to the Islamic God, it's an amazing thought if you go to think about it. Because I mean, who would know or who would even think that's the case? At the time, it was always Arabic scientists, particularly Islamic sponsors for research at the time. So typically, books would begin with this kind of contribution or dedication. And so we would see that not just Khwarizmi's book, literally nearly every scientific work of the time that defined our thinking today began with a dedication to God. And that's something to keep in mind if we ever feel like we need to think about where the Middle East could go in the future.
Well, and you also often have that separation now. You have people that say we've got religion and we've got science and there's nothing in between them. And so it's a fascinating... The whole thing actually, it fascinates me because I love history. And unlike many history books, this isn't bland and boring. It isn't, and on this day, this person did this. It explains it really well. And, you know, when I taught high school here, I taught at a local school. And I had, I believe is it Surah 94? The first commandment from God to man? Read and become educated?
Yes, Iqra.
And it was on my door of my classroom, and my students would stop and go, huh? Because throughout history, during the golden age of Islam, when you wanted an educated man, you wanted a Muslim over anybody else. And so I find it fascinating, the topic, as well as the call to action that you make the same point of, hey, we did all of this, and that Jim Al-Khaili makes, and we can do it again. Stop fighting, and let's invent something.
To these scientists and mathematicians, religion and God was a natural extension of their own logic about the world.
Hey, I mean, I prayed before my maths exam.
Yeah, I can't think of one atheist, even one atheist who doesn't. Realistically speaking, it's like every possible hope. Please help me. But to these scientists, it was like, okay, probably the best example is there was once a Bedouin man, right? And he just saw there were men passing by him, and they saw, and he was a believer in God long before Islam came about, like monotheistic God. And they asked him, you know, why do you believe? And he said, I see my camel's poop, and I believe my camel is there.
And with that, we would like to ask you to please stay tuned. We'll come back with our quiz question, and we'll be back with Jim Al-Khaili's Pathfinders and Camel Poop.
From Leo Tolstoy to Mark Twain, this is Talking of Books, in association with Emirates Airline Festival of Literature, only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back to Talking of Books. And we've had a fascinating discussion in the first half hour of Jim Al-Khaili's The Pathfinders. Let me remind you of what our two quiz questions are. If you send in the correct answer, you can win a copy of the book.
Oh, excitement.
These are great books. They're worth your time. The question about Pathfinders. Jim Al-Khaili is a well-known scientist. He's a professor at the University of Surrey. He has numerous awards and accolades. Just very direct. What branch of science is he a professor for? That's our first quiz question. And our second quiz question from the first hour from The Enchanted by Renee Denfield dealt with what controversial subject is the novel about? So send your answers into 4001. Don't forget to put your name. Or you can also send it to the Dubai Eye app. It's new, it's fast, and it's free.
I've already seen quite a few of the texts that have come in, and a lot of you have got it correct. And I'm very impressed, and you've all been paying attention, doing your homework, so I'm very, very pleased. And on that please note, I was wondering whether you would be able to tell us a little bit more about the theories and the ideas that are talked about in the Pathfinders book that we're discussing.
Okay, so the entire book is kind of a testimony to Arabic science in the Middle East, but at the same time, the focus is, for the body of the book, the focus, the majority of the content or the meat is about the actual accomplishments of these Arabic scientists, which is what makes it so amazing, so ecstatic, the fact that even people from this region, particularly people from this region, achieved so much in a time when the world was dark. From those achievements, a few stick out. Like, for example, the ultimate automatic one that your mind goes to is Khwarizmi with algebra. But then we've got the more nuanced ones, like, okay, let's take it one at a time. Al-Biruni was, as we mentioned earlier, one of the first men to so accurately estimate the circumference of the Earth, which at the time was a remarkable feat because we were trying to be cartographers. We were trying to develop maps of the world. And our maps were bad. You know, they were nothing like the map we've got on the wall in the studio over here.
Well, it's taken a while for Google Maps to get it right.
Yeah, data.
We want to talk about Apple Maps.
So, yeah, no Google, no Apple at the time. It was all just hand, pencil, paper, and thought. So Biruni, as we said, he calculated the height of a mountain. He used trig to calculate the circumference of the Earth. Then we've got the concept of the Indo-Arabic numeral system, which was a remarkable achievement of the time because the Roman numeral system was extremely limited in capacity. Now, Russell Peters likes to make jokes about how it was Indians who invented zero because we wanted to agree on a price to pay the rest of the world for our products. But, that is inherently true because it is the Indo-Arabic numeral system. The concept of zero existed long before we managed to, you know, draw a circle and leave it empty inside. The concept existed from Babylonian times, you know, and we evolved the idea over time, the idea of nothingness. And if you think about it, I mean, long before there was recorded history, the idea of zero, in one sense or the other, probably already existed. But it took a combined effort from mathematicians to formalize a system that would allow us to count to infinity. And that is what the Indo-Arabic numeral system is. Then you've got Ibn al-Haytham, who was one of the greatest physicists. I wouldn't be exaggerating to say he was one of the greatest physicists of all time. He's up there with the league in the likes of like we're talking like Newton in the likes of Newton, but
and
for
Archimedes.
Yeah, or Archimedes of his time. So he invented the first pinhole camera. He was the man who invented the first pinhole camera, which is
what was the time on that? What year? Roughly what year? What century?
About the 10th century.
Yeah,
about 9th or 10th century.
We're talking history that many of us don't even know.
No, we don't.
History that many of us have never even heard of. And yet, I want to mention that, but I'm not trying to interrupt you. This isn't just Jim al-Khaili making statements. He has what I love about this, my historian background, he has the citations and the background. So he went to Baghdad. He went to these places into the old archives. So his Arabic has to be fantastic. And then translated it from ancient Arabic to modern day to back up all of his claims. This isn't just some guy saying, yeah, the Arabs are the best.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's actually greatly reminiscent of what the Persians did at the time. They used to take huge corpuses of work from the Greeks, and it would be in a bunch of different languages. And what they would do is they translated all of them into one of the biggest kind of libraries of knowledge that we've ever, ever witnessed. I mean, like, the world was, that place in and of itself was a revolution at the time. So that entire corpus of work, that standardized system, was all developed by the Arabs and the Persians of the time. Then we've got, who else have we got? We've got Al-Kindi, who is probably one of the more looked over philosophers of the time, but again, one of the greatest ever. He was instrumental in the whole concept of being speculative and using logic and reason to approach the world. And he was, again, one of the first men to extend the idea of infinity to beyond, far, far beyond what we originally thought it was, its scope. Then, who else did we have? We had Ibn Sina, Ibn Rushd, all great men who, again, revolutionized fields like medicine, and along with fields like math and science, also fields like medicine. And then we had Jabir ibn Hanyan, who was a remarkably, remarkably enigmatic figure, because he's known in one very, very, very small Wikipedia paragraph as the father of chemistry. So, I mean, you've got, when you say somebody's the father of one of the three sciences, you really, typically, you wouldn't see that in a...
You expect something longer than a paragraph.
Yeah, in a very, fairly badly cited paragraph on Wikipedia. You see that slightly being slightly more significant. And Jim al-Khalili contributes an entire chapter to that in his book. Because it was Jabir ibn Hanyan who began to approach chemistry from the perspective of the scientific method, which was in itself revolutionary at the time, you know, to test out ideas, see which ones work, see which ones don't. And in a chemistry lab, that doesn't always end well, but...
Do you speak from personal experience?
Don't talk to my school.
Oh, I'm worried now.
But, I mean, his entire approach to chemistry, and he wrote about, I think, something like 500 pieces of individual work in his lifetime. And we're talking about 500, and because he was such a massive figure, so many people used his name over the years that his entire corpus of work ended up adding up to about 4,000 pieces of work. And we don't know how many of those are the original Jabir ibn Hayyan, but regardless, he was probably this amazing, amazing figure in history.
What's also interesting to think about, I find, is that amongst all these fascinating theories and ideas that we still have today and have been the foundation of, as you were saying, you know, we're sat here in a studio because of a lot of the great thoughts and ideas that these people have had. But amongst all that, there are also the really laughable ones, like the idea that the human body was made up of four humours. I mean, that was still going around at the time. And the idea that the Earth was, that the universe was geocentric rather than rotating around the sun. So I find it interesting that amongst all these great thinkers, you always still have the dud theories that are still going around.
And I'm pretty sure 100, 1,000, 2,000 years from now, they're going to be giggling at us.
I know, I wonder what we think is, you know, absolutely correct today. Years later, people are going to just be saying, oh, no, toothpaste, that was all a lie, you know?
I don't know. I probably put my money on all our understanding of quantum physics at the moment. It's basically going to be irrelevant in a few years, and we're just going to turn around and laugh at how little we knew, which is, again, what we're doing of the last 100 years and the last 1,000 and the last 2,000 years.
The scientific method. Mm-hmm. Just plain and simple.
I've had a couple of really good text messages come in. Alyssa is saying, what fascinates me about the golden age of Islamic science is its spiritual value, similar to Carl Sagan, there we go. I'm glad you're with me to correct.
That's fine. Many of the, you probably also know this, many of the conventional physicists or theorists that we had at the turn of the century were very religious men. They literally said physics is the window to God, and they meant it. So when you see that moves back together, it's very interesting watching this movement that we have among science, that religion and science coexist, and then religion and science can't coexist, and then religion and science coexist. It's very fascinating. Now, pride. You are Muslim?
Yes.
When you found out, were you taught in your schools about these individuals when you were younger, or was it more of a, we just found out about these people? I mean, in the schools that you grew up in.
Oh, I had no idea that any of these people were around. I mean, there was, I think, one video in Islamic in maybe fifth grade or sixth grade, maybe seventh grade, about an hour long, detailing Abbas ibn Farnas, who was, he's not in Pathfinders. He was just a man who jumped off a cliff with wings attached to his back because he believed he could fly. So as far as we were concerned, Arabic scientists of the past were nothing short of dud theories. They would be dud men, effectively, as far as we were concerned.
So in a way, then, this also changes the way Arabic science is taught or should be taught. Do you think that this should be a required text?
This particular book?
This one, yes. Or anything about these theorists and other people?
I would argue that if we were going to study, if we're going to study the history of science, the history of science is not just Western science. The history of science is global, is a human initiative. And therefore, Arabic science is equally important. And I wouldn't say that's out of place in any science classroom, to be honest, that book.
No, I agree with you. I think we've become too used to the idea in popular culture that science is all Galileo and Copernicus, and mm-hmm. that these people who we've not heard of, you know, don't matter. And they do. They matter incredibly. And I think it's a wonderful idea that you brought this book up. And also, did you get to see Jamal Khalili when he came to the festival?
Yes, I did.
You did? Yeah. Did you hear him speak?
He was awesome. It was actually awesome. My brother loved him. And this is the same brother who got me a book because he couldn't be bothered to read it himself. My brother loved it. Loved him. And that's saying something. He was a remarkable speaker. He's truly, truly enigmatic.
So Amazing. Is he talking about his book on stage?
Yes, he was talking about Pathfinders, and you could see the kind of passion he had and the kind of pride he had for the region and for his work within his speech and within his presentation. So he's hilarious, and he's a very refreshing person to listen to, and the ideas he brings up are equally refreshing. So,
and I have to compliment it. I keep saying astounding because I'm running out of words, but history in these ideas, they're not his field. I mean, they're in his field of study of these individuals, but he's not truly a historian. And yet he's gone to the effort to make, you know, any school should grant him a PhD in history, because this is a historical dissertation, and it's brilliant. And so that you don't find that often. You know, people that are great at math generally can't explain things very well or very easily, and they don't write very well. And this is just a breeze. It's easy to pick up. It's easy to go through. And, you know, even his like you were discussing here in page 100, where he's talking about the numbers you were talking about earlier, in half a page he explains everything on why you need the number system so you can count to infinity. And I'm going, where was this guy when I was taking calculus? I would have loved to have been in this class.
Professor Al-Khalili, he writes a lot about polymaths in his book and a lot about Renaissance men who can do a lot. And he himself can probably be described as one to some extent because of the kind of fields that that his work spreads and branches across. He's very, 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 very influential in spreading science in general to the general public, like Michio Kaku, for example, who's another very, very, very relevant, very famous scientist. And I think that's what his work is kind of imbued with that wit and charm and refreshingness.
Yes. I'm amazed, actually, on many levels. First of all, that you're...
Fifteen.
The last couple of times I've been on, the young reader has been 15 or 16, and he's reading stuff that's making me sit back and go, wow.
I've sat out in the booth, you know, before you come in, and I've been listening to the radio while I've been preparing my own stuff and hearing them, thinking, yeah, okay. And then I walk into the room and see that they're, you know, half my age, and just go, right, okay. Yeah, I really don't like how you're making me feel ridiculous right now, but okay.
That in and of itself is pretty remarkable, don't you think? The fact that like kids my age have access to information like that.
Cause absolutely.
Think about like the Bethel Hikmah, the House of Wisdom, the library of the time. To bring together that kind of knowledge and information was a struggle. I mean, it wasn't easy. Mm-hmm. And for these men to get access to that information was a privilege. Right now, it's commonplace. So we should use that.
Okay. Well, we will return to talk to Taher in a moment. Please stay tuned to more Talking of Books.
This is Talking of Books with Isabel Abahul, John McDonald, and the rest of the team, in association with Emirates Airline Festival of Literature.
Don't you just love that jazzy music?
I do. Good morning and welcome back to Talking of Books, where we're talking about Jim Al-Khalili's Pathfinders, the Golden Age of Arabic Science, with Taher. And we've had a really interesting discussion. We've had several people sending in correct answers for the quiz questions. Let me give those quiz questions to you again. To win a copy of Pathfinders, can you answer the question, Jim Al-Khalili is a professor at Surrey University. He has won numerous accolades. He has been a speaker here at the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature. What branch of science is he a professor of? And our quiz question from the first hour was dealing with the book The Enchanted by Renee Denfeld, and we wanted to know what controversial topic did that cover. Now, looking over some of our SMSs, we have a great SMS that had come in from Elisa talking about, she says, look at music. Even the chords of the guitar come from the oud, A-O-U-D. A-O-U-D. But then again, science is also a theory. Theory can't be proven. It can only be disproven. So science is actually like religion, a scientific fact, or is it just something that hasn't been disproven yet? So isn't science still a theory? That's a fascinating question. I just figured I'd put that out to you guys.
That is a deep question right there. Okay.
What would these guys say?
Okay. Yeah. All right. So, like I said, I don't want to turn this into, you know, science versus religion. I want to turn this into science supplements religion, or religion supplements science. Okay? Let's take it from that perspective. You've got the scientists of the past. To them, the existence of a god, and perhaps to some degree you can say this is a product of their time and the place they were in, because they were always exposed to Islam from the moment they were born. But these were men like Al-Khwarizmi, who literally developed algebra. Their logic was in a different plane of existence altogether, you know? Like, you can easily say they're like, and that in itself is not a reasonable argument for anything. Just to say that somebody's smart is not an argument for any of their beliefs. They have to be able to back it up. That's how science works. So what these men, to these men, it was, the Quran itself doesn't ask the question, does God exist? Because it's God himself speaking. So if you don't believe, it's like, you know, just you have to accept, you accept God exists. Like it's something that's so intuitive to in the Quran. And to these men, it was equally intuitive. From my personal perspective, not being one of the lofty thinkers of science anytime soon, I'm just going to say that from my perspective, science in and of itself is a belief system. Descartes, in the 17th century, he did something called the method of doubt. He began to look at everything in the world, every possible proposition there is, and he began to think, is there any possible way this could be wrong? Okay? He thought way far out, because he wanted to come up with one baseline on which to base the rest of all of knowledge, right? He thought, okay, why can math not be entirely true? We could imagine some evil genius out there messing with all our heads, making us miss something in all these proofs where 2 plus 2 doesn't equal 4, it equals 6 or 8.
Or fish,
yes. So we can't with certainty, absolute certainty, say that math is accurate. And if math isn't accurate, then everything else around us just falls down. Everything we can observe, everything we measure, everything just falls. So then he said that the only way for us to be deceived is if we exist in the first place. Therefore, cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. So to him, the baseline of all knowledge was that consciousness equals existence. To me, that's possibly maybe the only thing we can say for certain. Besides that, the whole of the scientific method relies on observing the universe around you, making deductions. It uses deductive reasoning, yeah? So you look around at the universe, you see what can be proven or disproven, and you work based off that. But our senses aren't reliable, to say the least. You're believing that your senses are telling you what you're seeing. It's a belief at the end of the day. It's not a fact. You know, fact always comes in quotation marks. At the end of the day, you're believing that you're seeing something when you really might not be seeing what you believe.
You might be in the Matrix.
Exactly. Exactly.
This could all be a dream, this entire radio show.
Exactly.
All an illusion.
All of you are figments of my overactive imagination. I'm by myself in a room where I can't see the sun.
Oh, and now we're back to capital punishment. Another
let's
tear.
Come back. Let's
I feel like someone's going to break down crying pretty soon. So we gotta
No, we're not going to break down crying. I do have a question for you, because you mentioned a wonderful library, and when, if nothing else, we are massive fans of libraries on the Talking of Books show.
Yes, we are.
Now, the Library of Alexandria is famous. Everybody knows the Library of Alexandria burned down, terrible tragedy. Can you tell me more about this other library that I had never heard of until today? Perhaps I'm just incredibly ignorant.
No, you're not. The Beit al-Hikmah, the House of Wisdom. Okay, so at the time, one of the most significant contributions of all these scientists and mathematicians wasn't just science and math, it was translation. What they did was, they did a lot of standardizing for us. They standardized the numeral system for us. They allowed us to count to infinity. They also standardized the language of global science. And at the time, it was Arabic. The world's international, the scientific international standard language was Arabic at the time. So what these Persian, the majority, some of the greatest translators, and we do call them the greatest translators because the work they did was no easy feat. You know, Al-Kindi basically figured out how to translate just by reading the text in their own language. Like, he didn't know what the parallels were between his language and their language, but he made inferences based on what the text was trying to tell them, right? And what the possible context would be of the time. They translated works by reading the language of the work without knowing the language. These were the kinds of men we're talking about. So the greatness of their work should not be underestimated here. What they did was they took all the texts from around the world, all ranging in different languages, they translated it to Arabic, and they stored it in one storehouse of knowledge. And that's what we call the Beit al-Hikmah, the House of Wisdom. At the time, the people who would sponsor all of this, the Islamic research, they were the ones who would sponsor these translators, and they were the men who, the entire Abbasid Empire was sponsoring this project, this massive project, right? So the first astrolabe was also sponsored by these men, the first the world has ever seen, right? So, or at least one of the best. So the Beit al-Hikmah was sponsored by these men. Whereas the Library of Alexandria burned down, the Beit al-Hikmah literally burned out of history, right? All the pages, all the work they did, just gone, poof, in smoke. And to say that's a tragedy is to put it extremely lightly.
Yeah.
Is to put it extremely, extremely lightly.
Well, with that, this hour has blown by. We're running out of time, so let's get back to our quiz questions really quick before we wrap up this hour. To win a copy of Jim Al-Khaili's Pathfinders, The Golden Age of Arabic Science, the quiz question is, Jim Al-Khaili is a professor at Surrey University. He has won numerous awards and recognition around the world. What branch of science is he a professor of? In our quiz question from the first hour, to win a copy of The Enchanted by René Denfeld, is what controversial topic does the book itself cover? I want to thank Tahir for coming and for actually giving me something new to read, because this has been really eye-opening. And, you know, I don't like thinking that I'm ignorant. Very rarely do I think I am, but this dealt with a lot of ignorance that I had. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great. Great to have books recommended that we wouldn't normally pick up. I mean, I wouldn't probably have seen this in the bookshop. I'd have probably picked up Gone Girl, but no, it's fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on and for talking to us.
I'm glad.
And then stay tuned for our third hour and our book champion slot.